and I'm saying that in all seriousness. Luckily for me, they found that I wasn't the culprit, as they found. And he was actually my senior, young officer from the British Air Force, but he was a Czech, but he was in the, the Czech pilots were part of the British, British RAF. And he kept telling me that I've got to be careful and I must keep my mouth shut and, you know, so I won't join the party, that'll get me into trouble, he kept saying, you know, and it was he who was giving the thing away, and he was hanged. So I had a very narrow escape, and then I managed, you know, to get to England.
Was that difficult to do, to get back to England?
Oh, very, it took a year for me to bribe the authorities to get me a passport, you know, to because my passport obviously wasn't recognized anymore. I actually managed it because they realized they were accusing me unjustly. And I said, look, I don't want to have anything to do with politics. I don't care if you communist or if you democratic or whatever, I want to go back to England to my sister. I've lost my family here. I've got my only sister in England. Please let me go. That's all I want. Let me leave my job. Because the first thing you had to have to be able to get out of the country was permission of from your boss. And the Ministry of Defense couldn't give me that permission, really, because of the political sort of tie-up. I could have given a lot of secrets to the other side. But in the end, I managed to anger.
Just to get back to the before your escape, do you remember that the Germans had passed anti-Jewish laws when they came into Czechoslovakia? I mean, could you still go to school?
I was under the Germans less than 3 months, because they came in March, and I left on the 1st of July, 3 days before my 11th birthday. So, of course, there was nothing yet at that time. In fact, the first time I was really aware of what was happening, though we heard rumors, let me just go back a little. I was with this very caring but very poor Christian family. I called my foster mother Mummy Rainford, and Daddy Rainford was her husband, and they had a daughter, Dorothy. I'll never forget what happened when Mummy Rainford came to claim me at London. I was waiting for her in a big hall. There wasn't anyone left there. All the other children, all the other 239 children had been, including my sister, had gone to their respective guardians. And I was left there all alone, and I was really scared to bits. And then this door opened, and there stood a little lady, hardly taller than myself, and she had these big glasses and a hat which sat all askew on her head. And as she saw me, she started laughing and smiling and crying at the same time, and she ran towards me and flung her arms around me. And she spoke some words I didn't understand then, but they were, "You shall be loved." And loved I was. And you know, those are the most important words any child in danger, any child in need can hear.
And she was married. She was married.
They were married, and she had a daughter who was 3 years myself. And that's another thing which I'm being interviewed because they happened to get hold of my book and they were over the moon. So they made a little film on Nikki and me, and then I was speaking. starting your milk.
Remove the pause. I should never have stopped it when the...
Oh dear, I see.
There's the pause button.
It's in there.
It says record. And it goes back to pause.
Pause again. Record again. It's a shame Matthew isn't here still. He probably might know. Have some coffee, maybe it'll settle down by then.
Let's see. Let's take the hold off. I think if it hears a voice, it might.
If it hears a voice?
Yeah, I think that's probably.
Hi, my name is Vera Gissing. Can you hear me? You be a good boy, son boy. And
yeah,
don't go on the trick. So have a sip of your coffee and then you'll be. Shall I put it on? Oh, no, better not. Spill it on there and then it'll be bad again. So we go with the dentist, weren't we?
Yes.
Yes, so. My English mummy, Mummy Rainford, as I was asked to call her, was the first female lay preacher in Lancashire. But she didn't just preach religion. She lived it every day of her life. And she sort of made me realize that it doesn't matter where you worship, as long as you believe in God. And as long as you do what you can.
Do you think her religion motivated her to take you in?
I am sure that it was, the motivation came from the whole family because they discussed it as a family. As I said, they weren't affluent and it meant sacrifices from them and from their daughter. And when they asked her daughter, would she mind having a sister? Younger sister come to live with them, and that it would mean she'd have to share her pocket money, and that they'd only have one short holiday a year. She said, no, I don't mind. Let her come. But please, can I give up my music lessons?
Do you remember what she said about her husband, what he said about her husband said?
Yes, that's what I was just going to say, okay. Yes. And when years later I asked Daddy Rainford, the man of the family, why did he do it? Why did he choose me? And he said, I knew I couldn't save the world. I knew I couldn't stop war from coming. But I knew I could save one human life. And as Chamberlain broke his pledge to Czechoslovakia and Jews were in the direst danger, I decided it must be a Czech Jewish child. And Dorothy, their daughter, chose me from about 6 photographs of children because she liked my smile. So I was very, very lucky. But that sentiment from Daddy Rainford has done the rounds of so many talks and so many films because it's really such a powerful statement and such a worthwhile statement.
It's like Nicholas Winton.
Yes. I never thought of it before.
You're an 11-year-old child, and you see this woman, you're all alone in this large place. Do you remember what you felt when she came in?
Well, I was shaking at the knees, I tell you, you know, who would come and play me. And I didn't know any English. All I knew is, was, I have sister, Eva. I have hunger. And the third one was, I need toilet. And, you know, and I mean, it was very scary. We went on a train to Liverpool. She left me in the compartment and ran off. And I didn't even know where I was going or what was her name, you know. But anyways, and then she sort of suddenly appeared back with holding a large cornet of ice cream triumphantly in her hand, you know, for me to have. Now, I was very lucky with my family. They didn't try to make a Christian out of me, but they didn't also. They didn't have any Jewish friends. They didn't think it was significant. They felt the most significant thing was to make me happy, to make me one of them, to show me how fond they are of me, and at the same time never try trespassing, sort of almost pretending they're my parents. They didn't want to take the place of my parents. They want me, after the war, to hand me over to my parents as their child, which of course didn't happen to lots of the children whose guardians weren't as thoughtful as the Rainfords.
Where did they live?
They lived in Bootle, which is a rather slummy part of Liverpool. But then when war started, and I was actually evacuated to yet another family, together with their daughter, Dorothy. Then later on they rented a house, sort of halfway between Liverpool and Preston, so that we could all be together again. But when, after Dunkirk, when the British troops had to flee back to England, and there were many Czech and Slovak troops who were fighting in France at the side of the British, fighting the Germans, they also fled to England. They were actually headed by our second president, President Beneš, who was now president in exile, who managed to get out with several of his of the members of the government, and he set up a proper sort of a government core here in Britain after Dunkirk.
If I'm remembering, Beneš wanted to fight the Germans when they came in.
Oh yes, Beneš was very all for it. He, because we had the best fortifications in the whole of Europe, at the where Sudetenland was, and it was a tremendous fortification against the Germans. And then we had to open them, you know, let them have it. And that's when all the refugees poured into Prague. But it wasn't that Beneš let them have it.
It was the British.
He was forced, yes, by Britain, that he has to cede the Sudetenland to preserve world peace. But of course, he didn't preserve world peace, but he did buy England and France a bit of time.
Peace in our time.
That's right, as you say. Waving that little white piece of paper, you know, didn't last very long, did it?
How long were you in communication with your family when you were in England? Did you?
My parents.
Did you correspond with them at all?
Oh, my parents and I, and my sister, we were writing nearly every day. But once war started, there was no real news. We did have one or two little notes sent by Switzerland, some friends in Switzerland, and then it all ceased. And that's when I was and felt so fortunate at having the Sun and the Stars and my diary, through which I remain close to them forever.
Did you have any idea when the war started what was coming?
No, I was an optimistic little girl, and there weren't really any news about the camps for several years. And it wasn't until March 1943, and by then I was in a Czechoslovak school. There was after Dunkirk, there was a Czechoslovak school set up, because quite a lot of families fled from Prague to France and then, you know, to England with Beneš's sort of army. And it was rather strange and typical me, actually. I mean, I loved writing even then, and when I heard that President Beneš was in England, you know, I was beside myself, and I wrote to him. It was nearly Christmas, and I wrote to him, sort of showing my faith in him that soon he would lead us back into our beloved homeland, you know, and signed it. And anyway, and I got a little visiting card from him, you know, in acknowledgement.
He responded.
Yes, he responded. I was 13, not quite 13 then. And then I heard, because I was terribly homesick for Czech music, anything that was Czech, Czech bread, I missed Czech bread, I hated the English bread, it was just like a sponge. Anyway, when I heard that there were going to be the Czech soldiers and airmen singing and dancing in the main theatre in Liverpool, I begged my foster father to let me go and see them. And he said, oh no, because by then there were doodle bags, you know, dropping. And I said, listen, if the Czech president isn't afraid, surely you're not going to be afraid of let me go. So anyway, he came with me. And I took this little visiting card with me. And during the interval, I marched up to the box where they were sitting with the mayor of Liverpool. And there were two Czech soldiers outside, you know, standing sort of with their guns, looking very serious. And I said, I gave them the visiting card and said, would you please tell the president that Věra Diamantová wishes to speak to him? Of course. But they looked upon me, you know. But anyway, I went in. And, you know, he remembered my letter. And he asked me to sit with them for the rest of the performance, and said, this young lady, she said to his wife, she wrote me such a lovely letter, you know. And he started quizzing me, was I happy, was I looked after, what I missed most, and I said, well, of course, my parents. And then he said, is there anything else? And he said, and I said, yes, I miss not being in a Czech school or not learning, carrying on learning Czech. And he said, but you know, there is a Czech school for children like you are, and it's a bilingual school, and we founded it only after Dunkirk. And
where was the school?
The school was then in Shropshire, and in a place called Whitchurch. It was a little town in Shropshire, and they gave us a sort of a old house which was sort of falling to bits. But it was wonderful. He got me there within a week, and I was on I still had my foster family to go to in holidays, but I was taken out of their responsibility except for the holidays, and I was more or less like a warden almost of the school. But there were so many of us, like Uta, you know, she was there at the same time as I, and the friendship we forged there have lasted to this day, because most of us there had lost our parents, and we were each other's family. And it's been, again, a wonderful gift, you know, that because we all shared the same faith, we all lost our parents.
Were there all Jews at that school?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, there were quite a few, you know, I would think about probably 40%, because there were also members, of course, children of the government and the soldiers and airmen's children, you know, and people like Bacha Works, which was a shoe factory, which had its factories also in Czech Moravian. that it had its shoe factory also in England, and so about 6 children came from there. But apart from my parents being so very much missed, they were the happiest years, you know, I had for a long time.
So what year did you go there? 1940 after Dunkirk?
It wasn't 1940. It was founded, I think, about 1941, somewhere around there. And it was first in Whitchurch, and then it moved to the Central Wales, and we were given a hotel and even a bit of a river and a lake, you know, which belonged to the hotel. So we were in seventh heaven, and we still have our reunions there to this day.
And how long till the end of the war?
We were there till the end of the war, and I was the first one to hear when war ended that my mother had survived. I had it in writing from her that she survived, and please let the children, we are well, and going back home, and it was signed by her Christian name Irma and her sister's name Bertha. But by the time I got the note, she was already dead, but of course I thought she was alive, and that was the worst thing that could have happened, that all the years of the war, I was preparing myself for the possibility of not seeing her again. And then she was given to me. I was the first person of the school to hear, and everyone, he was so happy for me, so pleased. And I thank God every day, because it was the only thing I wanted in life, to see her again, to look after her. I mean, I was 16, but I wanted to work there, I wanted, you know. And then I enlisted in the first transport the school was organizing to transport us repatriators back, those of us who were orphaned. You know, a couple of days before I left.
You got the word?
But you see, all that is in my diaries. And that part of it, I think I gave you sort of some leaflets, didn't I? And there's one where a girl speaks, you wouldn't have time to look at them, but from a certain school where I was speaker before I even met Nicky Winton. And that absolutely shakes the youngsters, because it's got the heart in it. It's not that written by an old woman looking back at her childhood. And the actual letters, my mother left the most wonderful letter to say goodbye the day before she was taken into the camps.
She went to Auschwitz?
She went first to Theresienstadt, then she went to Auschwitz, then she went to Hamburg. They had to work, you know, during the air raids to see the German guards. They used to take bets how many will be killed by British bombers, you know. And then she ended up in Belsen.
And she died of typhus.
And so did my cousin. But you see, the letter she sent, I mean, that the news that she had succumbed to typhus, that letter, the news was given to my sister. And she wrote me the most wonderful letter, which is in its entirety in the book. She broke it to me so gently, you know? And somebody even thought that father had survived, you know, and then we hear that he was shot on a death march. And again, just months before, after 3.5 years, with him it was 4.5 years of terrible suffering, because he was taken first to the little fortress in Theresienstadt, which was the most renowned, the most awful prison for political as well as Jewish dissidents. And mother managed to bribe somehow the Germans' guard there a month later to let him go to the normal Terezin ghetto. She didn't know she was successful, but when she got to the camp, you know, there was father. And during that month, he went from his jet black hair, he was only in his 40s then, he went completely white. All his fingernails had gone, 2 fingers had gone as well, they were taken away with the you know, under torture. And he never really recovered. You know, he went from camp to camp. But so, you know, their lives were prolonged, but with a lot of suffering. And it was very, very hard for me to come to the fact that God gave me mother back and then took her away.
As long as you brought it up, what is your religious, if any, religious feeling?
I'm proud to be a Jew. I would never deny I was Jewish. But I had mixed feelings and often asked myself for years, who am I? What am I? And then in 1968, when Dubček was in power and Czechoslovakia was joyous and happy, I was sent by the BBC to do a program on what the Czech woman was expecting from the sphere, brighter future. And I was there, it was the first time I was there from 1949, which was when I, you know, ran away for the second time to England. And I was absolutely overwhelmed how patriotic I felt, how at one with the people I felt. I felt even more emotional when my two daughters, because my two daughters were with me, one was 6 years old, the other one was 10 years old. And it was while I was there on this task I mentioned that the Russian tanks rolled in and the Prague Spring was over. I'll never forget riding in a friend's car through Wenceslas Square, and there were Russian tanks, some of them burnt out, and people lining the streets looking like they did look when I saw the Germans marched in, because their country again was no longer ours. It was a most dreadful feeling. And then suddenly my 11-year-old daughter put her arms around me. She says, "Mummy, now I know, now I feel how you must have felt when you were my age and saw the Germans march." And it was such a moment, such an important moment, because then there was a tremendous bond from that day.
Very perceptive.
Know. Yes. And it was, instead of broadcasting about what the Czech woman was expecting from the brighter future, I had the task of telling them what the nation had to put up with now.
So you had told your daughter about your experience?
A little bit. Little bit. Not. I didn't sort of want to burden them in any way. But I think it was then that the seeds of indecision but thought of writing my book came into my mind. This was strengthened in 1985. When the 1985, it was 40 years from the end of the war, and I managed to arrange a reunion of the Czech school in the hotel, which used to be our home. And my job was publicity, so that we could find as many children, in inverted commas, of course, we were all grown up, as possible. And I sort of contacted many the newspapers, I put some articles also in Queries in America, and well, everywhere, because we were scattered. We had scattered, and anyway, on that first reunion, I think I found about 50 children altogether, and one of the things I did. I was asked by the Woman's Hour, because by then I was with them, I was on a very good, we had a good relationship from the time I was in Prague. Incidentally, that I gave the talk as an unknown woman, because I didn't dare give my name in case I got some of my friends in Czecho into trouble. And it was voted the best program of the year with Dame Sibov Thorndike and what's his name, Chevalier, Maurice Chevalier, and our name Czech refugee, and it was broadcasted into every country. And it was at that time that I was interviewed for that program, and also for the Women's Hour decided to do a sort of a feature on it as well. I was interviewed by the Welsh BBC, and they said, when I answered their questions, as I've been answering you, they asked me, they said to me, Vera, what did you do the day war broke, there was the end of the war, what did you do? Did you celebrate? And I said, oh yes, we celebrated, and I said, but you know, I can't exactly remember, but because this is such a special occasion, you being here, I'll tell you exactly. And I went upstairs and I opened the box which housed my diaries, which I hadn't opened for 40 years. And I took it down, I found the relevant date, and I translated it exactly. And they were sitting there and tears were streaming down their face and said, Vera, we studied the Holocaust. But this is something completely different from you. We've learned the feel of it. You've got to have those diaries translated. You know, you've got to. You promised you would. And I said, no, I won't promise. And I looked at me shocked. I said, I am a literary translator. You know, so they said, what are you waiting for? And I said, but I now explain that it would be very hard for me to go back for them and really... Because of what happened with my parents. But, you know, it was very therapeutic once I started writing. I used to write through the night in my study, overlooking open fields, the moon above, and I felt absolutely close to them, and that's how I wrote the book.
It must have been very emotional to go back over...
It was incredibly emotional. But you know, when we had the reunion, it was only a week later after that event that we had the reunion, I realized that in the book I didn't have just my story. I had their story too, the rest of them. A whole community of people who were like family, and that I owed it to them too, and to the kindness of the British people who took us in.
In 1985, you didn't know about Nicky Winton.
No, I didn't know about Nicky Winton at all. it took me about 2.5 years to finish the, 2 years to finish the book. And then, of course, I was looking for a publisher, a good publisher. And I found a very good Jewish publisher called Robson Books. And anyway, but obviously... I did a lot of interviewing as well, updating the people I knew, you know, so that I could draw them into the story. And nobody knew who masterminded our rescue. And I was then with my partner, Harry, who was a Jewish colleague of mine from the school. We were in the same class for 3 years, so we were very close. Our class was just like a family.
What was his last name?
Steinhauer. And he managed to get, his parents and sister managed to come here after him, you know, so, and we knew each other from the Czech school, and both our marriages had broken down. He married a Chiksa and I married out as well, and so it was rather nice, you know, to be together. And anyway, as I said, he's died now, but we decided to hold that reunion, and it just went down so well. And he was friendly with Esther Anson, because you saw the film, didn't you? And you know where we embrace, where Nicky and I embrace, and that was Esther Anson's program. As it happens, Harry looked after Esther Anson's teeth as a dentist, and her husband was a writer as well, Desmond Wilcox, and he was Jewish. She wasn't. She went into the faith, but she wasn't Jewish. Oh, well, I suppose that's some message which hasn't come through. And And anyway, I don't know if I was going to say.
Desmond Rook.
Yeah, I know. I was talking about Desmond Rook on the basis of them.
Did he read the manuscript?
Yes, he wanted to read the manuscript, and he took it home, and he said, not only did I enjoy the story, it'll make a beautiful book, but it'll also make a wonderful film, and I know just the man. And you know, the film was on its way of being made, and in fact, they worked on it for 2 years, and put nearly £1 million in it, and then there was a recession in the film business.
But you pretty much wrote the screenplay for them, didn't you?
For Mackay?
Yes.
Oh, yes. It wasn't just a screenplay. Right from the word go, Mackay found my book in Czech, in the Jewish museum, or in the Jewish library, because it's come out in many languages. It's coming out next month in Japanese.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, even Japanese. Anyway, so when he found the book, he was absolutely over the moon, and he used part of it for All My Loved Ones into the film. I don't know if you've seen it. That was his sort of first film of a Czech Jewish pre-war family and how he disintegrates, and how suddenly he could use Nicky Winton's, with his permission and through me, he could use the scene to save the youngest child of that family, you know, who came to England. And as I said, it was pictures, but lovely, lovely film. You should ask him to show it to you. It's really. And he used lots of the pathos and the diary and various things with my permission, again, in this film. That's how it started. And of course, when he heard that, apart from Pearls of Childhood, I had spent 3 years researching and putting together the story of the transport and interviewing masses of kids I just wanted to say thank you to Nicky, and I couldn't think of a better way than doing that. And I spent a whole week. I was supposedly in Prague on holiday, and he came with his laptop every morning about 6 o'clock, you know. And he was so enthusiastic that I was very glad to sacrifice my holiday to tell him everything. And then I helped with everything. I gave him all the contacts. I gave him even, the photographs. The shots where Nicky in his young days is holding the child. And the people are waving. I mean, I knew where he could get it in America, because I had happened to meet a lady who made a little film and was and used that, you know. So it was just great. And what I appreciated was that he's young, and he felt in his heart it's a story that's got to be told on film as well as in book, and that he was willing to risk his shirt, you know, to do it. Come in. Oh, sorry, I could have opened it.
Come in.
Oh, good.
Oh.
Yes, have you been shopping?
No. No, often we went to the gym.
Oh, that's why you look so thin now.
Yes.
Anyway, you've got to finish this.
Yes, okay.
Do you want some
on.
Coffee? There's a cup there.
Oh, yes, I do.
Thank you.
Let me take you back just for a second. I'm going
to
ask you the same question. When you were sitting at the dinner table with your family before you got on the train, and your mother said the next day you were going to leave.
No, not the next day. It was the next month.
But she had basically announced that you were leaving.
That we could leave, because she was waiting for father's reaction.
What was your reaction?
I was flabbergasted, and at the same time, a little bit afraid and a little bit excited, because as far as I knew, no one from our town had ever been in England.
This is an adventure.
Yes, and my parents sort of tried to make me think of it as an adventure, and as an opportunity to learn another language, see other people. I think, and I'm pretty sure, that they tried to persuade themselves that we would be back. I think if they admitted to themselves that there's a big possibility we would never see each other again, they wouldn't with it. I don't know, but that it would have been much, much harder.
And the night before you left, was that still the same kind of ambivalent feelings about going?
There was never ambivalent feeling about it. It was just almost trying to convince yourself, saying it to yourself, to give you the strength to turn your back on your own children. You know, I mean, it must have been a terrible, terrible decision.
And when they took you to the train station?
Well, when they took us to the train station, they took us first to my grandparents' house. And I remember sitting on my grandfather's knee, and he had this big beard, and I always hated it because it was so prickly. But this time I didn't mind. And then my grandmother, who was completely blind, she sort of went over me with her fingers, as if she wanted to remember, you know, every bone, every part of my voice, my face, as if she wanted imprinted on her sightless eyes. You know, it was incredibly sort of moving, but I still kept saying to myself, we'll be back within a year, and it wasn't until we were in the train at the station, and until then our parents sort of kept a brave face, but as the train started to leave, I could see anguish on their faces.
Did anyone cry?
I did. And I mean, you know, it was dark, wasn't it? And there was sort of, in those days, there were steam trains, and there was steam pouring. I was lucky because my sister was next to me, and she put her arm around me, and she said, don't cry, you always have me. I might be a poor substitute, but remember, you always have me. Turn to me, please, if you're lonely, if you're homesick. You know, and I mean, I didn't like her very much in the old days because she was bossy and clever and all the things I wasn't, but from that moment on, she was the best sister in the world.
Do you have that memory of steamy platform and waving goodbye?
Oh, yes. I think those sort of memories never leave you because it was such a turning point in our lives.
Is it a daily occurrence? Something comes into your mind?
No, definitely not a daily occurrence. Look, I mean, I've had the chance, which very few people have, of keeping my parents alive through my books, right? And it makes me proud that I can do it, and so glad that I can bring understanding to the younger generation, you know, through the book, or through the books, really, because they can identify with me as a little girl I was then, and growing up, you know, under these extreme circumstances, we had to grow up.
So you were grown up at age 11. You grew up at age 11.
Really, yes. To a big extent.
Do you have a kind of reaction getting on a train?
No. I do when I am in Czecho. You know, if I go to my hometown, which is outside Prague, they still use exactly the same trains as when I was, you know, 10 years old. And they still, you don't have a platform, you know, you just get out of it in the middle of nowhere, and then you make sure that there's nothing coming either way, and, you know, you run across. And that's always, I can always smell how they were, and also the seats are as hard as they were in 1939, yes.
Mm. So you left in July
1939. Yes, 1st of July. And I think one of the nicest things that happened to me recently through what I had achieved, the Czechs had made a film on my life called Identity of Vera Gissing. It was an excellent film which had been shown twice to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the end of the war. And Pearls of Childhood was read unabridged at the same time, you know, during that same period. And I was told that there never had been such a reaction, positive reaction to the book, so it was repeated again. So, you know, so I didn't feel proud for myself, I felt proud for my parents. If it hadn't been for them telling me to write, you know, and to keep in touch and everything, I wouldn't have had the material.
And as a child, you don't remember any resentment of being sent away? You never felt that way? This was for your own good?
You mean for my...
For your parents?
For my parents, resentment.
I mean, did any of the children feel that they were being sent away by their parents?
Yes, I think that when Mickey Winton came on the scene, which was in 1988, just as my Pearls of Childhood was at the printers, we had meetings, you know, we had get-togethers, and he actually told us that there were some that they felt, as you say, they felt resentment that the parents wanted to get rid of them. Or there were also other children who, although they didn't want their parents to die, they were the younger ones, they'd forgotten their language, they'd forgotten what their parents even looked like, you know, because they were perhaps 6, 7 years old, and they were dreading going back. They didn't want their parents dead, but they had accepted that the English people they were with, you know, it was quite a mixture.
So there was some identity crisis for some of the children.
Oh, yeah.
Hidden children frequently have it.
Well, I'm not surprised hidden children have it because, they were really in a different situation, which was more horrific because, we were loved or liked at least and looked after. You know, there was the odd person, an odd child perhaps, who didn't have such... positive experiences as I have and my sister had, but on the whole, we were very lucky. And whatever happened, even if somebody made you scrub the floors or whatever, at least we were alive. And I remember that when I found, or I was given, after going back to Prague at the end of the war, a letter which my mother wrote to say goodbye to my sister. And I was living with my auntie, the one who's my mother's sister, who buried mother in Belsen. I cried my eyes out after I read it, and I said I should have been with them, you know, I should have been there to hold their hand and everything. And my aunt just went ballistic. She said, "Don't you dare say that, don't you ever dare say that. Don't you realize that the one happiness both your mother and father had, and I," she said, "was knowing in safe hands in England." So it's...
Nothing simple, is it?
No, life isn't simple. But you asked me about my identity, and I just wanted to say that I was torn into shreds about wondering, where is my niche, where do I belong? And then when, after the war, and when Dubček was in office, my husband... had a very bad coronary, and he decided he'd take me to Prague first. You know, I hadn't been since I ran away in 48. And it was when we were there, one of our colleagues from Europe, Rwanda, took my husband and me to the Jewish Museum. And I don't know if you've been to the Prague Jewish Museum, but it's a little old museum, synagogue really, museum, where now the walls are lined with all the names of the Jews who perished, including, but they weren't there then. All there was, a little round staircase, and at the top there was a little room, and it had like a tree trunk in the middle with a notice just paint to it, and scribblings of drawings around the walls. And the words on the notice board said, "This is all that remains of the 15,000 Czech Jewish children." And at that moment, I saw my cousins in those pictures, I saw myself in those pictures, and for the first time, it hit me that would have been all that remained, you know, if it hadn't been, I didn't know about Nicholas Winton, but for my parents' courage. And I remember sort of just leaving my husband, who was looking at it from a different perspective, because he wasn't so connected, obviously, from that angle. And I ran up the rest of the staircase, which is entry forbidden, and there at the top stood Yula, this friend from my class, from the Czech school, and the tears were running down his eyes. I could tell he felt just like me, and we just hugged each other and cried together like two children who were so lost themselves. But it was there in that little Jewish museum that I found my identity. I realized I was proud to be Jewish, but I was Jewish by race, Czech by birth, and English by choice, a mixture of all three.
That may be a good place to start.
How much time is it?